From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. As we near the two-month point of the officially declared global COVID-19 pandemic, people are looking forward to resuming their normal daily activities. Cases of the disease and the number of COVID-19-related deaths have been leveling off in some areas, while both continue to increase in other localities. Despite warnings from public health professionals, a number of government leaders in the U.S. and in other countries are easing mandated restrictions that had been implemented to slow the spread of COVID-19. On today's program, we are going to talk about the impact the pandemic is having on society and what is needed to safely reopen the world. Today's show is divided into two segments. Dr. Peter Hotez from the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, is my guest for the first segment of the program, and Alexander White from Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, joins me in the second segment. Dr. Peter Hotez is the Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development, and he is also a pediatrician and author. Dr. Hotez joins us today via Skype. Dr. Hotez, the last time we spoke, a key issue regarding the COVID-19 pandemic was the issue of testing. Are testing levels where they should be here in the U.S. and in other countries?
Well, they're certainly getting there, and they're better than they were. But here's the thing about testing. It's not just testing in a vacuum. It's now testing in a way that's strategic and opens up the economy. What do I mean by that? People are now faced with the prospect of going back to work. They need to feel safe in the workplace. And right now, I'm not certain we have a system in place to make them feel that way. So what needs to happen? What we need, take an example. Take any store you want to mention, whether it's Walmart or Target or take a legal office. People need to know that their colleagues are not asymptomatic and spreading the virus. So that means a system in place at the workplace where people are being tested on a regular basis. If somebody's found to be positive, that those individuals need to be counseled on how to isolate or quarantine themselves if they're a contact. And then you have to bring in people responsible for contact tracing. That means ramping up hiring in state and local health departments so people can come and identify all of the potential contacts, encourage them to quarantine or isolate if they're found infected. And then in parallel with that, a whole system in place of syndromic surveillance that involves maybe an app system, if given the how ubiquitous iPhones are. None of that is in place right now. The point is an entire new health system needs to be implemented now in order to make the economic recovery meaningful. And instead, what you're seeing happening is governors are saying, I'm all in. We're ready to do the economic recovery. They're bringing in, you know, distinguished business leaders across the state. But it's not being linked to a public health system infrastructure. And I'm worried it's going to fail as a consequence, because if people start getting sick again and start going back into ICUs, the whole thing then unravels.
What I'm picking up from seeing different things in the news is that people themselves are a little unsure. They're not really comfortable with going full bore into trying to normalize things. You've got an issue where you've got small businesses, for example, who have employees who are scared to come to work, and you've got customers who are afraid to go into those businesses. Your thoughts on that?
You know, it's all over the map. We've got, you know, some heads of households who aren't getting a paycheck right now and are desperate to figure out a way to feed and clothe their families or pay their bills. And, you know, they're prepared to go back to work no matter what. You have others who, right, are suffering from some form of PTSD, and appropriately so. I mean, we shouldn't even give it a label like that, because it implies something pathologic about it. It's a normal reaction, right? The fact that they're terrified about going to work and getting COVID. And so how are we going to put in place the mental health counseling needed to manage all this as well? And so it's a very complicated endeavor. And again, the worry is we're taking care of the economic recovery, but by failing to link it to a new public health infrastructure that needs to be implemented, I worry the thing falls apart.
Some say that the politicalization of the pandemic is costing lives and leaving more sick people in its wake. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, there's no question this is highly politicized. And, you know, I get to see it firsthand by, you know, going back and forth on CNN and MSNBC and Fox News, probably one of the few that's doing all three cable news. And I love it. And it's an amazing opportunity to speak to the country. But you really do get a sense that things are, even with this horrible pandemic and the epidemic component here in the United States, when we're supposed to be bringing the country together, things are still pretty polarized. There's been some good things happening as well in terms of bringing the country together, and that's why I worry about this summer, that things could blow up as the political divides grow bigger and protests mount, and I'm worried about time of political foment and instability.
There have been some positive signs out there regarding the pandemic, but the fact remains that people are still dying from it.
That's right. I liken it to the eye of a hurricane. Mm-hmm. You know, just because now we're in the middle of it and going down, it's like being in the eye of a hurricane. We've been through the first part, but guess what? There's a whole lot of wind and rain still coming. And we know about those here on the Gulf Coast. So I'm still concerned that, you know, if you look at the models coming out of the Institute for Health Metrics in Seattle, you know, it's really showing that, you know, it went up pretty abruptly and now it's starting to go down a little bit of a longer slope, but it really doesn't go down till the end of May. And so the modeling says we're not going back to containment mode, which is defined as one new case per million population per day until June 1 for a lot of states. And you know that nobody's going to wait for that time, or very few states are going to wait for that time. So that's going to be the tension.
Doctor, the current COVID-19 pandemic is often compared to the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 and 1919. And history tells us that the pandemic killed in three, perhaps four waves back then, with the second wave supposedly being the deadliest. Could we see another parallel to this, especially since Dr. Robert Redfield, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, recently warned that the coronavirus might be more difficult during a second wave next winter than we've experienced over the past 2 months?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility, although I would change that up and say I'm worried it's going to be the third wave, because the second wave is, if we don't open up the economy properly, we could see a second wave this summer or fall. The third wave then comes in the winter months, and this is based in part on an excellent modeling study published in Science Magazine by Mark Lipsitch and his colleagues at Harvard, who, based on other upper respiratory coronavirus infections, have modeled it to suggest that we could see annual peaks in the winter for a few years out. So yeah, I think that's a real possibility. Whether or not it's going to be worse than what we've had, it's hard to say. But what will be difficult is if we are lucky enough to have pretty flattened curve throughout the summer and fall, it's going to be problematic to get people to want to social distance again as we move into those winter months. And that could be a precarious time as well. So I think the bottom line is, you know, we're all working furiously to develop a vaccine. My colleagues and I don't sleep a whole lot getting this out into clinical trials. We have an aspirational goal of a year to 18 months. That's very optimistic. We can't just sit around waiting for the vaccine to appear. We've got to map out a roadmap, a strategy for the country, taking into account what happens if we relax social distancing too prematurely without a health system in place, what happens if this comes back during this coming winter, and have a very realistic plan for how we manage that. Right now, I'm not seeing it.
The big thing we were talking about last time was that you were looking into testing former COVID-19 patients for antibodies. How has that testing been coming along? Are we seeing any optimism there?
Well, there are antibody tests, but remember the context of that. The context of that was to identify patients that had high titers of antibodies to collect their serum and use that plasma and use that as a treatment for COVID-19 patients. And this was something spearheaded by my colleague Arturo Casadevall at Johns Hopkins and others. And they've been writing papers about this. And I think this is now underway. So it's certainly underway at multiple academic health centers. There's some oversight now from the FDA and the Center for Biologics Evaluation Research. So I think that's moving along. And how scalable it is, I don't have firsthand information yet, but it seems to be ramping up. And right now, as far as we know, that's the only treatment that we know is probably going to work for sure. Well, I shouldn't even say that, but it worked for the first SARS virus, and I have some optimism that this is going to be promising.
Dr. Peter Hotez, thank you so much again for joining us.
I look forward to continuing to update you, and thanks for all the good work you're doing at Voice of America.
That was Dr. Peter Hotez, the Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, co-director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development, and he is also a pediatrician and author. Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. If you have access to the Internet, please check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel VOA for alerts and program updates. Today, we're talking about the impact the pandemic is having on society and what is needed to safely reopen the world. My guest in this segment of our program is Alexander White, Assistant Professor of Sociology and History of Medicine and an Associate Director for the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. He joins us today via Skype. Alexander, as the COVID-19 pandemic continues, we've already seen significant impacts on virtually all aspects of society. What notable effects have you observed so far that may last or even increase once the pandemic eases?
That's a very interesting question. I feel like what we've seen most starkly, and what is really the most concerning long-term lesson that we've learned from this ongoing pandemic, is just the ways in which health inequalities have really been shaping who gets sick, who has the most severe cases of COVID-19, and who ultimately dies from this disease. Especially in the United States, we're seeing that our existing health disparities are a significant predictor of severe cases of COVID-19. And, you know, I believe this is both a horrifying realization, but also an opportunity to develop some very serious responses to the gaping inequalities that we see in terms of health and social inequality more broadly in the United States and around the world.
So in other words, Alexander, we're still looking at perhaps the impact of the pandemic on marginalized people around the world. That includes minorities, the poor, and the displaced.
Absolutely. Epidemics don't necessarily produce novel social and political phenomena, but what they often end up doing is exacerbate existing inequalities and existing structural inadequacies. And I think we're seeing a lot of that take place around the world today.
Past major pandemics have had their own unique impacts on society throughout history. Can you give us some examples of past pandemics and how they have affected society, not only in the short term, but continue today?
I think that if we look back, most significantly, the major pandemic that we look to is almost an analog to this one, though biologically and epidemiologically, the diseases are quite different. The case is obviously the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic. And we look to that as that's really the most recent example of a deeply global disease that brought about the similar sorts of widespread controls, social distancing, and isolation that we're seeing currently. I think we learned a great deal from that particular pandemic. We saw the effect in the 20th century that severe epidemic diseases can have on the structure of society, on the nature of rates of deaths, and the effects on population. What's important to note, I think, about that pandemic in particular, is that epidemic was effective at spreading in part because of the crises that had emerged after World War I. So this disease emerges on the world scene at a time when health systems were destroyed in much of Europe and much of the rest of the world, and states were structurally very weakened as a result of years of what was essentially the most bloodthirsty war in human history to date. And what we see in that is the ways in which epidemics really take advantage of existing weaknesses in our social structures and in our political and economic systems. So another example, I think, you know, we don't have to look back as far, is related to the Ebola epidemic in West Africa that happened just a few years ago. This was a similar epidemic that was able to exploit the existing weaknesses and gaps in health systems in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone that had been largely ravaged by a series of wars for the last 10 to 20 years. And this social and structural instability allowed in so many ways for this epidemic to become as vicious as it was.
You have to admit, though, that the West African Ebola pandemic was one that killed a lot of people. But a few years later, another Ebola pandemic broke out in Africa.
That's correct. I mean, we're currently still seeing some cases of what's been the most significant Ebola epidemic since the West African one in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And then I'm starting to sound like a broken record, but we see there as well how the fragility of existing health systems and the fragility of state structures in so many ways, in that case brought on also by a variety of civil conflict and violent conflict, weakens the capacity to respond to an epidemic as aggressively as we might hope and limits the capacity for dynamic, effective health action.
Again, looking back to history as a comparative example, I would imagine that each pandemic had its own set of circumstances and effects that were unique to its time. As time progressed, humans' understanding of and the technologies to treat and prevent diseases that cause mass infection, illness, and death has improved, at least somewhat compared to previous outbreaks. But have you found any commonality from past pandemics or any lessons learned that may help us return to a sense of normalcy once the COVID-19 crisis subsides?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think on one level, it's important to note that the most common comparison being the 1918 influenza pandemic reflects a scientific moment at that time where actually the influenza pathogen was not discovered. And we're working with a real paucity of information. Today, we have far better techniques and technologies for healthcare and management of severe and intensive illnesses. So, you know, we have the ventilators, we have the capacity to intubate, we have all of the medical technology and expertise at our disposal currently, which didn't exist previously. However, there are still some commonalities that I see, which is that really, given that COVID-19 is a novel disease that we hadn't experienced before, and we had to produce, you know, novel and effective testing for that and new measures to manage, surveil, and ultimately treat the disease. In some ways, we are in a similar position as the world was in 1918. And thus we have to rely on, you know, what are called non-pharmaceutical interventions, social distancing, quarantining, isolation as the most effective measures to mitigate this crisis, measures that still need to be in place in the absence of testing and sufficient rollout of contact tracing and other things. But I do see hope for a transition to a new normal. I think, you know, we've been talking so much in the press about the new normal of COVID-19, isolation, being stuck at home, the economic precarity. But I think we also need to transition to a new normal after this, where we don't go back and replicate the same mistakes that got us here in the first place. We need to take seriously health inequalities, and we need to take seriously the disparities that have made this pandemic all the worse across the world. And we need to strengthen our health system so that we're more prepared for our future epidemic emergencies and make sure that we can treat and respond quickly to these epidemics in ways that are both scientifically rigorous and effective, and also in ways that don't exacerbate those existing inequalities.
Alexander, right now, most people are at least trying to put some of the guidelines established by the public health community into practice in order to help prevent the spread of infection. I'm curious, though, about post-pandemic behavior. Do you see people in general adhering to these guidelines once the current pandemic subsides, or do you foresee the opposite reaction like we're seeing in some areas here in the United States and in some other countries where we resume less cautious hygienic practices and rebel against the imposed restrictions that have been put into place by local to national governments?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of risk of that. I think part of that risk, while I firmly advocate for maintaining social distancing practices as much as one can, I recognize that the economic precarity and instability that exists at this moment has made it difficult and complicated the effects of this pandemic beyond purely the epidemiological or the biological effects of the disease. So my first suggestion would be that with a more successful and broad, wide-ranging economic and social safety net, some of the anxieties around having to provide for one's family that are associated with this move to quote-unquote reopen the economy might be assuaged, and people might be more accepting of social distancing practices. So for one, I think there are ways we can mitigate these dangerous health behaviors through further social support. But I also think that we've seen previously in a variety of epidemic situations, as the disease subsides or perhaps the worst case scenarios become less likely, that people revert to practices that might still be dangerous or threatening for the spread of the disease. And this leads to future waves of smaller but also significant epidemics that happen after the initial shock. Similar to an earthquake, the aftershocks can also be devastating. And I think that that's something we really need to avoid.
And we can compare this to the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 and 1919. History tells us that these deaths didn't come from just one wave of viral infection, but at least three waves. What lessons and guidance should we take from this in addressing the current COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, so that's exactly correct. Part of the successive waves of influenza in 1918-1919 were the result of particular aspects of the nature of the disease itself. So aspects of it were biological, but also this was a result of social responses. And I must stress that in the absence of a vaccine, the greatest tool we have at our disposal against this virus is the non-pharmaceutical interventions of social distancing and the practices that we've been applying. So vigilance is necessary, and levels of discipline are necessary to keep this in check in particular ways. And that's difficult and hard for many, many people. And I recognize that. But until we have an effective vaccine response, or until we have the sufficient testing and contact tracing technology, you know, this is a reality that we will likely have to face.
There's an old adage attributed to philosopher and author George Santayana that might be appropriate these days. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. What are your thoughts on the saying's relevance today in light of the COVID-19 pandemic?
I think it takes on a great deal of relevance on a number of different levels. I think the most immediately what comes to mind is obviously the ways that we see the possibility for future waves of this pandemic to emerge in the event of weakening policy around social distancing, and the ways in which we might see, you know, significant peaks in new cases should we attempt to revert to normal behavior pre-COVID-19. And I think that would be very dangerous. But I also see that the ways in which that particular quote responds to the ways in which this epidemic has really highlighted the ways in which our widening gaps in inequality are harming people's lives and putting lives at risk in a way that is having a disproportionate effect during this epidemic. And I think that once this is all said and done, and even in part in response to this epidemic, we really need to take these inequalities seriously and really need to figure out solutions so that people can have effective healthcare access, but also we lessen the social gaps that exist that make people more at risk of getting sick or more at risk of putting others at risk as a result.
Although leading public health officials have been warning against governments withdrawing social distancing and other restrictions too soon, a number of U.S. states and other countries who've been hit with the pandemic are moving forward to ease these restrictions in efforts to normalize daily life. What happens if what the public health officials have been warning starts to happen, and like the Spanish flu pandemic, we see multiple waves of infection, illness, and death? Has this happened with previous pandemics? And what impact do you think this would have on society today?
So the important conversation that we need to have around removing restrictions really revolves around kind of a transition in philosophies of control of this disease. Right now, we're focusing very much on the number of cases and the number of deaths. What we need to see and the technologies that we need to put in place in order to really move to the next phase in response to this pandemic is very, very high rates of testing and very, very effective contact tracing. So what that means is we need to be able to test large swaths of the population to make sure that they either do or do not have COVID-19, and then whether or not they're capable of spreading it. And then the contact tracing element comes in, which is that we need to also know if someone have tested positive for COVID-19, that we can trace their contacts and know who might be at risk and who might be possibly spreading this virus further. And that gives us really a much more complex understanding and network for understanding how this disease is spreading and then how we can stop it and break those chains of transmission. And this is really the important critical epidemiological step that we need to take to ensure, you know, somewhat of a return to a post-pandemic moment. The critical aspects here are kind of whether or not we have enough testing capacity and whether or not we have enough contact tracers to carry out this new and important objective. I would consider, you know, any attempts to reopen society or move towards reducing the social distancing measures in the absence of these really quite dangerous, because then, you know, we're back to a situation where we may be unsure about the scale of the epidemic taking place right before our eyes because we lack the diagnostic and public health capacity to get a hold of this and get ahead of the epidemic.
It seems as though we're in what could be described as a catch-22 situation. We want to protect ourselves from this disease, but at the same time, we're seeing our economic infrastructure sort of collapsing all around us. You can see why people have become frustrated with the restrictions that have been put into place, because people are losing their jobs, they're losing income, losing health care coverage, and they feel powerless. They need the money and health care coverage in order to pay for medical care, but at the same time, doing so would put them and others in danger of infection.
Precisely. And these are exactly the traps that I'm most concerned about, and in many ways I think are most important for us to address both now and sustainably after this pandemic subsides. What we've seen in some of the Northern European and Western European countries that have perhaps might be closest in actually moving towards the process which I just described of partial relaxing of social distancing measures with aggressive testing and contact tracing. What they also did was put into place very significant social and economic support systems so that people who lost their jobs or lost income would be protected by the state on some level, with certain nations providing up to 80% of salaries to people who were rendered unemployed due to this pandemic. And I think that that level of social safety net goes a long way towards reducing the anxieties, the economic anxieties especially, that compound the epidemiological and biological anxieties that are associated with the virus itself. When people are forced to make a decision whether or not to sacrifice their physical well-being for their economic well-being and sustainability, that's a false binary that I don't subscribe to. And I think, you know, ultimately more can be done and more has been done in many places to make sure that this isn't a devil's bargain that someone has to strike.
Alexander, you've done a lot of research on the impact of pandemics throughout history. Based on what you've learned, can you paint us a picture of what life will be like once this pandemic subsides?
As a social scientist, I am always a little leery of attempting to predict the future. We're usually not necessarily right. And if we are, that's often a problem in and of itself. But what I would like to see is really a transformation in the ways in which we think about epidemic threat and the ways that we consider structures and ideas of empathy most significantly. I think that the world leaders have scrambled to sort out a variety of the issues associated with this. We're seeing a wide swath of community-led responses to provide and take care of those who need the most support at this time. And I'm thinking about food delivery services, the actions of food banks and other community organizations to mobilize around the situation and attempt to provide support where perhaps leadership has been lacking and fill the gaps as they're needed. I hope that demonstrates something very important, which is a role of empathy in an epidemic. And what I mean to say is that so much of our social distancing practices are relying on the fact that, you know, not only do you not want to get sick, but also because this disease can be spread asymptomatically, you also don't want to risk the health of others. So we take all of these measures out of an abundance of care and compassion for one another so that we protect our broader society, friends, family, loved ones, and people we don't even necessarily know to make sure that this pandemic doesn't get any worse. So I hope that after this, we actually see that recognition carried forward into a variety of other areas. But also, I think in more specific policy and practical terms, I hope that we see a transformation in how infectious disease is managed at an international level between states, and also more focus given to the real devastating threats that these diseases can cause. And on a national level, especially in the United States, I hope that we can move forward in reducing the social inequalities that have really exacerbated the scale of this epidemic in the United States.
Alexander White, thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule to talk with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
That was Alexander White, Assistant Professor of Sociology and History of Medicine and an Associate Director for the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today, and please be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.